This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. My guest this week is one of the major creative forces in daytime television drama in the last, 40 years or more. Shelley Curtis has won 4 Emmy Awards, or maybe it's more than 4. How many Emmy Awards?
8.
12. 25 Emmy Awards for her work as a producer and director, and dozens of nominations, and has been nominated by the Directors Guild of America. She's currently directing Beyond the Gates on CBS, and I'm thrilled to get a chance to chat with her. Shelley Curtis, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, Gary.
Yeah, I want to know everything about you, but we need a little background, because you're a very mysterious presence on the internet. There's not a whole lot about you, and is that something that you've taken pains, to achieve, because soap opera fans are obsessive? And...
No, I always think I overshare. I'm always shocked because I don't know. I always think, oh God, I'm oversharing. But I feel like if you look me up, you don't see a lot about my kids and stuff, but you do see bits about my career.
Well, but you came from a show business background. Your father was an actor, wasn't he?
Father was a stand-up comedian.
Oh, uh-huh.
And
what was his name?
Dick Curtis. And how we entered Beverly Hills, I went to 14 different elementary schools. Just living in the back of a car, going from gig to gig with my dad, my mom, and my sister. And by the time we were in Australia, Laugh-In and Jonathan Winter's show was launching. So they flew us in to Beverly Hills. Mace Neufeld was my father's manager. Remember Brad? And so Mace got us this little house on Maple. We moved there. I started school, realized I had no skills, school skills, zero, because I had really gone to school. And I remember telling my father got a job on Jonathan Winters, playing his straight man, and then working at these different clubs, the Horn. They didn't have as many comedy clubs then. And I remember walking around and saying to my mother, I am never leaving here. Whatever this is, I'm never leaving. And I never... And I studied acting because I thought that's all I was supposed to do. And as you know, we had a wonderful drama teacher at Beverly.
You and I, we went to the same high school. You probably don't remember me, but I was the boy that was following you around like an obsessed soap opera fan.
I do remember you. Oh, yeah. Store on Santa Monica Boulevard.
That's right. Yes.
And how cute you are. You still are. And you were very, very cute.
Thank you.
Not so cute.
I've got a face for radio. But so you planned on an acting career.
I just planned on that, even though I really didn't like it. And everybody was going to college. And I thought, okay, I have to go to college like everybody else. I still had not gained a lot of skills. And I went off to San Francisco State. And I think I was there about 2 months. I was paying for it myself. And I was very unhappy. And I thought, this is not what I want to do. I'm not cut out for school or college or anything. And I didn't get involved in a drama department there. I didn't know anybody. So I just borrowed some money, got on a plane and came home, figuring I should work. Maybe I'll work a couple of years and then figure out what I want to do. But I'm sitting in here in these art history classes is not moving me anywhere. And I hated my roommate. So rather than kill her, I was going to leave. So I got a job.
That's a good decision right there. It's so
yeah, good decision. Probably a good, healthy decision on my part.
Yeah.
Then I got a job at Mirabelle's on Sunset. And I might have been too young to serve alcohol, but they liked me anyway. So they let the busboys do the wine deliveries or whatever. And in walk all these actors. And they all said they worked on this new soap opera that was going to be canceled. They're calling it new because they hired a new producer to revamp it. And that was Tony Geary, Jeannie Francis, Kin Schreiner. So if you don't know, that's Laura, Luke, Scotty Baldwin, you know, all those characters. And I said, well, can you get me an interview there? And I'll get you extra, you know, syrup with your pancakes.
Well, you were a big fan of the soaps?
No, I'd never even heard of a soap opera. I'd never watched one. Uh-huh. Literally. I think there was a show called Edge of Night when we were young that was supposed to be scary.
Oh,
but I never watched it. So I went down to ABC. They got me in. I walked into this woman who just took over the show, and she was chewing on tobacco. And she said, this is not a training ground. And I said, well, I will do anything you want me to do for free, as long as I can keep my night job. So that's what I did. I followed her around like a little dog. Whatever she wanted, whether it be a cup of coffee, I'd run and get her a cup of coffee. She'd pour it out and say, get me another. Maybe it was cold. I don't know. And then I just followed her from edit room to edit room. She was the first producer. She was one of the first women directors, but she also was the first producer of soaps that went outside the studio. We shot everywhere.
And what studio? So most of the soaps were made in New York, but this one was made in Los Angeles?
Young and Restless and Bold and Beautiful and General Hospital. A Days of Our Lives. Mm. They're all LA, and then the rest of them. There were so many of them. I never watched any of them. Even when I was working on General Hospital, I never watched any of them. And then we'd go to the Emmys, and every year the winner is. And I had a funny, Brett, I was telling you earlier about Brad Bell. Mm-hmm. He was Bold and the Beautiful and Young and the Restless. And we were recently at a party, and somebody said, how do you know Shelley Curtis? He went, that's easy. The winner is, and the winner is. And the winner, because his shows were up, but we would always win. And he just said, I never understood it. The winner is. That's how I know Shelley Curtis. I never picked my head up. I wasn't even a fan of the show when I first started working on it. I was really just learning how to edit, learning how to put scenes together. Once I learned that and followed her around shooting everything, I went, I can direct. I can do this. This is something I can do.
So when you got into soap operas, there were like many of them on the air. Now there's just a few. I was talking with suddenly can't remember her name, Melanie Thomas Scott.
Yeah.
She was here on the show, and she said that because of the OJ trial, when the OJ trial happened, people were watching it every day, and they stopped watching the soap. She said even the people on the set of The Young and the Restless were watching it every day. And then when the trial ended, people were out of the habit of watching the soaps, and that's one of the reasons that the soaps slowly began to disappear. Do you agree, disagree?
Yeah, I was there. I was on General Hospital the summer of that OJ trial. And I remember a dip in the ratings started to dip. Not only that, we all wanted to watch it, right? Because it was live TV.
Right.
At the same time, maybe a couple of years earlier, MTV started. Mm-hmm. And that pulled a lot of the young viewers. Because one of the things that I brought to the soaps and was kind of my job was young love, romantic stories, and music. I brought Baby Come to Me. I brought so many songs, because then you couldn't get them. They'd play on the radio.
Right.
You couldn't just go, or you had to buy them. But a lot of my friends were artists, and they said, can you put this song on there? It was easy for me to do that.
Oh, I see. So you didn't have to license them. They would
give it to you. No, they would go in a garage, sing a duet, and give it to me. And I would play it over and over and over for certain couples. So I was known as the love story producer director. I did all the young love stories. So when I started, I really hadn't watched anything. And then after 5 years of being on General Hospital, I realized, okay, I need to go out and do this on my own, because I can't be that girl who still gets the coffee, edits everything till 3 a.m. and, you know, fills in for everybody, which is what I was doing, which was great and fine when I was learning. And General Hospital was so hot at the time, everybody wanted anybody from the show. So Days of Our Lives came to me and hired me as executive producer and director. I'd never even heard of Days of Our Lives except for maybe the award shows. And it was a much slower paced show.
What was the sands through the hourglass? They go very slowly.
Yeah. The Corday family. And because these shows were traditionally owned by families, they also started on the radio, which is why they have they had that slow pace, because you talk it through and have all the sound effects in the background. And when it moved to TV, it moved for 15 minutes, then 30 minutes. Then I remember being there when it took 15 minutes more and then to the hour. So I guess I was there during all that evolution. It was pre-computers. Now when we got computers where you could literally edit your show at home and send it in. I do my show now, the one I'm doing in Atlanta, on my computer, and I just send it to them. You know, all the shots. You have to literally do all the shots, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah.
So I went to Days for 10 years, and I got really big reputation for love stories and editing montages and adding music. And think about these shows too, and you're all part of all the writing. You're in every writer's meeting, and I was in the control room every day. So I knew what stories were working and what stories weren't. You know, who had the chemistry, who didn't. I did all the casting. I did all, you know, with people. But, I mean, I was in that room. I directed the casting things. And
Were you younger than most of the people that were involved?
As it turns out, I'm finding that out now because everybody's dying. My husband said to me, if you remember, you were 15 years younger than everybody,
Yeah.
You know, the actors were 15 years older than me, the crew, everybody. Because I think I was about 22, 23. And then anyway, I did that for 10 years and I loved it. And then I left and did a show for Stu Billett. I was just had enough of it. They fired me. I don't know what happened. It was like a whole new network change. And like suddenly I was out and I'm like, oh, that's weird. That's so weird. And everybody was crying at my cake cutting. What couldn't understand it. But it was a nice little break for me because I did another show for Stu Billett, who it was called Love Stories. And it was really an interesting idea. It was an early reality show, definitely early reality. But then General Hospital called me back and they said, we have a new producer. She wants you as her partner. And that was Wendy Rich. Wonderful, wonderful woman, 10 years older than me, did movies of the week for, you know, for a lifetime and then that. And, I said, and I knew soaps. She did it. So we were a perfect team together. And I went back for another 10 years and had the time of my life because I got to do everything I wanted to do. I learned everything up to that time. So we went on locations. We hired Ricky Martin, who couldn't speak a word of English, went to Puerto Rico with him. And he was like a beetle there. I mean, you could not get through it. We used to have to do car switches. The cameras would go in one car. We'd get in a car and get out the other side of the car and get in another car. Because we couldn't keep, that's the only way you could do fan control there. And he was a doll. He had not come out with anything yet. He was just coming out of being a Menudo, which was a little band. And then he was on his own. Great, great. Still a wonderful person. But we launched a lot of people. It was so much fun. We could do anything we wanted to do. Wendy was open because she hadn't grown up in soaps. She had no, we could do anything we want. And we did everything we wanted.
Well, you and I were talking a minute ago about being at Beverly Hills High School, and our drama teacher was a guy named John Engel, and he was a terrific guy, and I loved him a lot. And then he retired from a teaching career, and then he started to show up on TV. I saw him on an episode of Cheers, and I saw him, I can't remember all the things that he was doing. He did commercials and stuff. And then all of a sudden, he was on General Hospital. He was like the star of General Hospital, right? Did you have a hand in that?
Oh, big hand. What happened was the first 5 years I was on General Hospital, Edward Quartermain was played by a man named David, and I'm blanking on his name, like a wonderful actor. And he passed away. And in my mind, that character was dead. Nobody could play him in my person. Just never. I have to think of his last name. Shoot. I left. When I came back, they wanted to recast Edward Quartermain, the patriarch of the show. And I said, there's one person, only one person who can play this role, which is John Engel. So I called him and I said, he said, oh, well, where do I come to audition? I said, there is no audition. You start on Monday. And he was perfect. He was wonderful. He not only was great in the role, he was a mentor to all these young actors, people like you.
Yeah.
Who couldn't remember their lines.
That's right. I couldn't remember any of my lines.
He'd say to them, come to my dressing room and I will run lines with you, even if it wasn't his scene. So he kind of shaped up our little younger group of actors and they all followed him around. And he was wonderful and a joy to work with at all times and funny and great, just great.
He was a wonderful guy.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah. We were lucky. We had good people teaching us at Beverly Hills High School, for sure.
Beverly was a great place then. I probably still is, but the teachers that I had there, particularly John Engel, they were so sensitive and understanding to the nerdy kids like you and me.
Yeah, yes. Right, it was a home for me. And, I was a terrible student, and I hated school because I was a terrible student. And I, really loathed P.E. I never wanted to go to P.E. And then once I got to Beverly, I just did everything in the drama department. So we had a stage movement class counted for PE. I mean, I spent all day in the drama department somehow.
Well, at least you went on to college and now you're a teacher. I couldn't remember any of my lines. Like John would say, Engel, okay, Shelley, what's your monologue today? And I'm like, So I would get up and do my father's comedy act.
Oh, that was good.
But I would make it, I would bring the pathos into it. And where did you get that from? That's unbelievable. Because my father had this bit about a kid who kills a rat and how upset he is about it. It's a comedy routine. But I made it this very sad story. And he would pull me out of classes so I could do it for visiting classes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that funny? But I was a terrible student, as you can see. I was terrible. I was good at on-hand eye stuff.
Well, you figured out the whole soap thing. So when you started working in the soaps, they were shot in L.A. What studio did they shoot it in?
ABC, Gower Studios. And then we moved to the other ABC in the valley, somewhere that way. Again, I don't have a direction. All I can do is get in my car and it drives me there.
Yeah. And it was shot on videotape?
Prospect and Talmadge, we shot there.
And when you did your editing, so it was shot on a big fat videotape in those days. And did you actually have cut the tape to edit and tape it together?
In the beginning, yeah. Then it started getting more computerized and you could roll back and redo it. It was still hard. It still took a long time. The way we do it now is insane. It's insane. You just go, oh, I want that shot over there. Tighten it here. Da, da, da. That's so easy. You can make your, it's less, it's just so much easier. And you can really do a story in the edit room. Now when I direct, I'm so fast because I know I already got the close-up. I already have that. I can do this. I put that there. Let's move on. We're moving on. And everyone's like, you sure we have it? I go, I'm positive we have it. Because you'll shoot it a couple of times. And I go, yeah, I got the two shot there. I got this there, that. It's just in my head.
So when you're... I want to define the different roles. We're talking with Shelley Curtis, and she is in the master of soap operas, and she's
never saw a soap opera in my life.
Director, producer, and all that. So, what's the difference between being an executive producer of a soap opera, the producer of a soap opera, and the director of a soap opera?
So, the executive producer is like being the head of a studio. You're in charge of everything. Casting. I mean, you have a casting director, but everything goes through you. But it starts, you're in charge of story. So you hire your head writers. We, in my case, producer and executive producer, we would read the whole arc, have a meeting with our writers. That's the hardest part are the writers because they're very sensitive. They come up with this long-term storyline and you basically sit in a meeting and carefully punch holes in it. And so you have to be overly sensitive about that because there's so much work that goes into it. So we'd take this whole long arc story and then we break it down into daily breakdowns. So this week we're going to build this week up to the crescendo of so-and-so getting murdered, or Luke and Laura are going to go on the run, or the big thing on General Hospital was the Luke and Laura wedding, the anticipation up to that wedding.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we got 14 million viewers or 15 million viewers. We were on the cover of Newsweek. Whereas now the soaps get a 2.1, a 1.2. We were getting, you know, Oprah ratings way beyond Oprah. And so that you build up to some kind of crescendo, and it always had to involve a love story. So I was really good at weeding through and putting the love story in. There were some people, the other producers were a little bit better at the longer arcs. And then I would be, you know, when I wasn't the executive producer, but even when I was executive producer, I was in the booth every day. 5 days a week, I knew those storylines. I knew those actors. And as a director, you're not in the story meetings, but you get an outline. You know what your show is. And then you get your show and you block it. Ground plans of the whole stage, and you literally block every move. So when you go in for your show, you tell your, you know, Gary, you stand here when you say that line, then I want you to cross the room, turn around, flip your head or flip your hair, or bend, you know, sit on the couch, sit here, sit there. Cause all of it was about lighting. You had to have all that lighting set up prior to the day you shot. Mm.
So you shoot it almost like it's a live show.
Yeah. You have to shoot it like it's a live show, but because of editing became much more reasonable, you do have to cut in the booth. So as a director, you're saying, okay, we're coming to one, ready one, two is better on two, better on three, stop, he's up, you know, kids, they go up on their lines. Okay, we've started, back it up, three speeches and action. So you can do it piecemeal, but you kind of have to follow your map as a director.
The director is not on the floor, but up in the room where the...
Both. Yeah. You go up in and out. Sometimes on the new show I'm working on, some of the directors like to be out there because it's kind of far. And so once they, because the blocking is very different now, you literally block it and tape it, block it and tape it. So it becomes a little more piecemeal and they like to be out there. I like to be in the booth because I like to talk to everybody. Because you're talking to the cameraman, you've got your technical director here, your AD here, who's going to take it all and edit it. You know, you can have your hand in editing anything you want, but they will take it and assemble with all your, you know, say, oh, take that close up. Don't use that. Tighten that up, blah, blah, blah. And then there's one of my most unfavorite jobs that I did was the person who times it because you have to back time it. So, okay, we're 5 minutes long. Okay, we're 6 minutes long. How did that happen? They always play the timing person. You go, well, you stretch the scene. You added a piece of music. It's 10 minutes long now. I used to love going in. I love going into a show long because I like clipping it up and moving things around. I love tightening because everybody goes so, you know, my biggest note is, okay, that was great. Faster and funnier, please.
I was watching, I remember watching a week of Ryan's Hope with my wife who liked that show. And on Monday, a girl goes out swimming while her husband is lying on the sand. And you see in the distance a fin. On Tuesday, she's swimming and he's reading a book, and the fin is a little bit closer. On Wednesday, they didn't have those characters. On Thursday, the fin is really close. And on Friday, he goes and gets her out of the water and nothing happens.
that very slow storytelling.
Yeah, and nothing happened.
Gloria Monty was very, very into pacing, fast. She spent a lot of times on her favorite storylines and they'd be like this. And if she felt like slowing down a Luke and Laura moment, she did. And other characters too. I just use Luke and Laura as an example because in my mind, everything was, we copied everything that love story was.
That was your mentor.
My mentor love story. Yeah. And then my own experiences and music and all that. But, we would try to move things faster. The other storylines move a little slower. And I don't know now. I'm just in this new show. They're being pretty interesting with their storylines, but there's always going to be those stories that you go, they move along slowly.
Yeah. I want to ask you, Shelley Curtis, I want to ask you some soap opera questions. So like, I've lived a while. I have never ever encountered anybody who secretly had a twin that nobody knew about till later. And also I have never encountered anyone with amnesia. I've never met anyone who had amnesia. It's never, ever happened. But in the soap operas, these are things that are very common. That
with having denial. Who are you?
I'll say it again.
Who are you?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, you have amnesia now. Here it comes. Oh, well, could you bring your evil twin in
so
we can finish? We can finish this interview with her. Also, I want to ask about aging. So, like young people, like kids, they could be 6 or 8 years old, and then the next season they're 16. But old people never age. You could still be. She's like 49. She's 52. She's expecting, or she may get pregnant, or something. Are there rules that soap opera rules?
Sure. I actually don't think we ever did that. I don't think we ever took a kid. Because we would have, Luke and Laura had a kid in my second go round. And we watched that kid grow up. You know, he was.
In real time.
He grew up on the show. He may still be on it sometimes. Twins are, that's a whole nother thing. Like Deidre Hall had a twin. In real life, she had a twin.
Oh.
But she would never let an identical twin. She never wanted her twin to play her. If she, you know, she was afraid that we'd do a storyline about the evil twin.
Well, that would be great because you could actually have them both on screen at once. It would be incredible.
But you could also shoot it and do two people on one.
Sure.
The one thing they used to do that I used to hate, and I said never on any show I'm doing, never. Because they were so tight on their schedule, if an actor got sick, they would have a new actor completely playing the role, walk in, and you say, the part is now being played by.
Right.
That was like my big never. And my big never is a character left the show. I would never, we recast the character on days, but we did, it's so much of a storyline. We called him Jack Black and he died. And he came back and his face was all wrapped up in a mess. So his wife didn't know it was him coming back.
Well, that kind of thing happens all the time.
And we shot so many scenes through the eye holes of the mask of him looking at her. He couldn't talk. Marlene, it's me. It's me. Now, I've never met anyone in real life that went through that, but I was convinced it was real.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, that's very clever. The point of view through the eye holes.
We don't do that as much anymore. You know, you don't do the recast unless it's there's a long time. Like in the case of John Engel, there was a good 8 years that before John Engel took over that patriarch of the guy who died.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I was there, if they played a funeral for him. You really don't want to do funerals. That's a good idea not to do that.
Yeah, because then you can't bring the character back.
But it makes it even worse.
Right.
But those are my no-nos. I didn't like any of that, so I never did it.
Well, you never show a dead body, right? If you don't ever show the body, then they can always come back.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
A girl eaten by the shark, you don't know.
That's right. She could have been.
We would never do a storyline. There would have to be some sort of denouement or whatever they called it.
Yeah, sure.
We always have a plan.
The stories seem to move faster now. Are you trying to accomplish
story? Oh, we started that back in the day. We just pace. Even starting in the storylines in your outline meeting seats. Because once they did their long-term, then the outline meter writers come in. There's a whole new group that does the outlines. And the head writer and the executive producer read those outlines, adjust them, and then there's a whole other group that are script writers. And some of them don't even live in town. They write the scripts. And they get notes too. And then the actors get it. And the director get your show. Like I'm waiting for a show right now and I probably won't get it till 4 days before I have to shoot it. So the minute I get it, I'll block it.
So if a television show is on every day, like when you were working at General Hospital or even now, when it'd be on the gigs on every day, how far ahead do you shoot?
It depends. It used to be a different, we used to shoot one show a day. That was the thing. You'd come in, you'd have a dry rehearsal.
Get the whole show done.
And then shoot it. Then it became too expensive. Then the soaps were being squeezed. This was before they got rid of a lot of them. And so we started to block and tape. And still that wasn't enough. So now what we do, I just did two shows and four segments in 2 days. Because what we try to do is they try to capture more scenes so we can get far ahead. I think Beyond the Gates is at next Christmas. I mean, they're on a month long break now, maybe a little longer. So they're very far ahead. I don't really know how far ahead. I just know 2-3 months ago I was there directing, and my show just aired like yesterday.
Ah, now when they're on a break, will they show old shows, or how do they take a break?
No, they shoot ahead. So all those segments that I did, or another director does, those are other shows. So they build it up during the week, so you end up shooting 8 shows in a week, 9 shows in a week, and then they get stored. And then when you're on hiatus, they keep playing.
When you're shooting a show, a soap, so you have segments with different characters, different scenes. You shoot all the things with those one characters at once, and then you edit them into the show, or you actually move back and forth.
We have two sound stages. There's a nurse's station, the main people, the mansion, the coffee shop, et cetera, et cetera. So you shoot by set. So if my show 212 has 6 nurse's station sets, but those actors are in 213, 214, meaning show numbers, I'll probably shoot those segments too because I'm in the nurse's station. And that's how we get ahead. Mm. But they're there, the actors are in, so they get 3 or 4 scripts. So today, you, Gary, have 4 nurse's station scenes from 2-12 and 4 more from this show. And because you're there, I'll shoot all of them. And then that's how we get ahead.
And so the actor has to know, I mean, there are probably scenes where they, I guess this is true when you film a movie, you film it out of sequence. I mean, they have knowledge that they don't actually know yet and things like that when they're.
They pretty much know. Let's say you're not that far ahead, like this, there's 3 or 4 shows, but you can, you know, it follows a storyline. So it's part of their storyline. They usually know it. You know, if they have a love scene and then they have a fight in the elevator, they just did a huge like tornado and people got stuck in elevators and underneath stairwells. So there was a lot of that in there. We shot a lot of segments that went into a lot of shows, but that's how they do it.
Well, I want to ask you about Beyond the Gates because it's unusual to have a new soap. It's only been on, I don't know, a year or so, right?
It's shocking to have a new show because there was that moment where I think it was Brian Franz. He came, I was just guest directing. More than guest directing all my children. They moved to LA. Wow. I used to fly there and do it, which was really fun. I loved that. That was my favorite. So they came here and I was pretty much a main director and Brian Franz got on a monitor and all the cast and crew on that show and all the cast and crew on, I think it was One Life to Live. They were all the monitors. And he just said, we're canceling both shows as of next month. Like, boom. People like Susan Lucci, who had worked her entire life, was standing there watching, my show's over. It's over. And everybody, it was really shocking. And they just dropped all these shows and left a few. And they replaced them with things like cooking shows and none of them worked. None of them. And I always thought it was so weird because I said, one of the studio executives, you want to launch this show called The Chew, which is a cooking show. Why don't you cut All My Children in half so you're not paying that much as much and incorporate The Chew in it? Like it's a show that Susan Lucci owns on.
Right.
And
yeah.
Because you have 3-4 million viewers. You're just throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Now you're going to try and scoop in new viewers that are soap opera viewers. So we could get your wife and her best friend who likes to cook, right? You get both of them.
Right.
It's for whatever reason, they threw the baby out with the bathwater. And then streaming has started, Paramount, plus all these streaming. And all of the shows now, the show I'm on now, is on CBS, right next to Bold and the Beautiful, or before or after. And then it's on Paramount Plus. And I was talking to Brad Bell, who does Young and the Restless and Bold and the Beautiful. And he said there's been a big uptick in ratings because it's easier for some reason for people to just go to Paramount Plus. You can take your scroller, go, oh, I don't like this scene. I want to go to the next storyline. You know, I'll just scroll ahead. Oh, I missed that. I'll just go back to that scene. It's easier. I mean, we know we could used to be able to tape and you can do all that. And you can fast forward. It's really easy on your computer. It's just right in streaming. You just zoom it back. And I find watching any TV, I had never watched Friday Night Lights before.
Yeah.
And my husband just had back surgery, not to get off the whole subject, but we watched all five seasons of it. And it's a soap opera.
It's a soap. Yeah. And it's a good soap. It's a really good soap. I enjoyed it a lot.
It's a really good soap. It's a more elaborate. You know, they took 10 days, 12 days to shoot one episode.
Well, right? The Pit is also a soap. In fact, we started watching The Pit, which everybody, it's a big popular show. And we watched about four episodes, and Robin said, oh, it's a soap. It's for people who don't watch soaps, but it's a soap, and I already know soaps.
It's a soap. Of course it is. It's modeled after Cedar Sinai.
Yeah.
Emergency room.
But it's modeled after All My Children.
Sometimes you can hear my husband's name, Paging, Dr. Litvak Paging, because they use all the when he doesn't work there anymore, but he used to. And the guy who runs the who does the medical stuff for the show, he puts all those people in. That's his little ad. But yeah, it's a soap. And so was Friday Night Lights. I mean, I really love the way it was shot. I love the way it was written. The characters are crazy.
Good music on that show as well.
What?
The use of music was quite good on that show as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was but it was a very expensive soap opera. We were very limited by budget, which is why I got my friends to sing in garages. You know, I just used everything I could do to get stuff in.
So it's unusual to have a new show like Beyond the Gates, and it's also a show that focuses on African Americans, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not the first one. There was another show.
Generations.
30 called Generations.
Yeah.
And it was, I guess, not good timing. This one, they just got 17 Emmy nominations.
Wow, that's great.
So they've really plucked in and they're doing okay. And they just got picked up for two more seasons. So there is an audience. I guess they're finding that there's a little bit more of an audience for it.
So maybe Susan Lucci will come back and we'll see Erica Kane visiting.
It's interesting you say that because they just did with Young and the Restless, a crossover with Beyond the Gates, brought like four or five actors.
Yes, you were telling me. And you got to direct both of them or just the Beyond the Gates segments?
No, both of them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, that's neat.
And then
it was on both shows or it was just on one show?
Just on our show.
Uh-huh.
We brought them there to do our show. But I there's a possibility they could swing Susan Lucci in. Why not?
Why not? I mean, what is she doing?
She's really she kind of disappeared for a while. I think her husband passed away. I used to see her a lot when she was here, but now she's got more of a presence on Facebook or Instagram, and she's sort of out there again. I think it's probably fun for her.
Yeah, I met her once because I went to the stage door in New York and watched them come out. And there's a bunch of fans there, you know. It was like a thing. You go with your autograph book.
Oprah Riverside, when they were over by the river.
Yeah, in New York.
And yeah, I
was excited because Ruth Warwick came out, and she played in Citizen Kane and lots of other movies.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And so I was excited to talk to her, and she came out. She had two shopping bags, which she put down and chatted with me without any like timetable. Not like, oh, I have to go. You know, I'm happy to talk to this boy who's asking me questions about Citizen Kane. And
I think this soap actors more personable. They like to see their fans. They like to talk.
She was very nice. And then when we were done talking, she picked up her two little shopping bags and she walked down the street and walked.
Wow. There she was.
And Susan Lucci posed for pictures. She's very short.
She's little, very petite.
Yeah.
Yeah, tiny. It's funny. We launched a lot of actors too on General Hospital. We launched Demi Moore, had her first.
Oh.
We hired her. She'd never acted, never been on a TV show.
I was in Paris once. And you know, when you're in Europe, you love to listen to the language and you kind of don't even want to hear English because it's like, oh, listen, you're in. Yeah. So I'm sitting with my back to somebody at a restaurant and this woman is talking in a very loud voice and she had a really foul mouth. Like she was really like every other word was. So I turned around to kind of like say something to her, and it was Demi Moore.
Oh my gosh.
So I didn't say anything.
I've seen her around here and there, but yeah, I'm not surprised. She was out there. She said good with herself. She said well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So who else came out of your soap days? Ricky Martin, Demi Moore.
Ricky Martin, Demi Moore, MacGyver. Who's the guy in MacGyver? Ricky Dean Anderson. He was a cute. He used to come in his roller skates. I mean, you remember all these guys were so young. Everybody was young. We had Elizabeth Taylor on the show because she was madly in love with Tony, Fury, Luke. So she insisted on having a big role, and she came on as a very evil woman.
Was she on the show?
A few months.
Wow, that's neat.
We gave her like a really, like my office and my producer's office as a combined dressing room. So we had to move into one of these little rooms. We were never in them anyway. And she always had an entourage with her, and she would always, she had this one line. She wouldn't, it was supposed to be outside. We had to make it inside because she wouldn't go outside. And she was standing there, and her line was, "I curse you, Luke and Laura. I curse you." And she was saying it, and I had to go out because she wasn't standing in her light. You remember I told you how important the lights are? They don't move them. It's too long. It would take a poker and a thing and a ladder, and it just slows your day down. So I had to go out there. I said, "Could you move a little bit to your left?" "Why?" I said, "Well, it'd be better on your face." So she goes like this.
She moved like a fraction of an inch.
And I'm like, "Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Thank you." And then she'd invite everybody up to her house afterwards.
Oh.
I was in charge of getting everybody home. "Okay, everybody, let's go."
Time to leave, Liz.
Cars, and it was the 80s. So she was a hoot.
Well, you've worked with a lot of actors, and you know, so was Elizabeth Taylor much better than the usual soap opera actress?
She was, she was playing a very big character, and she played it very broadly, which was great. In walks Elizabeth Taylor, and it's just like, it's Elizabeth Taylor.
Right.
She's overwhelmingly large in her personality, and she always came with an entourage, and they always had to be in the scene. Like, if we had a party scene, they had to be in it, even though they weren't really actors. They were just her entourage, which was fun. And then we had Dustin Hoffman there when he was doing Tootsie.
Yeah.
It was absurd.
Because he was,
very fun character. I don't think he ever was on the show, but he was there so much. And then who else do we have? So many. I should have prepared myself.
That's okay.
That.
Let me ask you about acting. Shelley Curtis, the director of Beyond the Gates on CBS. How do you deal with actors as the director? Are you just like, well, they're hired and they're going to direct, they're going to act, and you let them do their thing? Or do you give them line reading, or how do you work with them?
You know, in just different ways. You have to, you go out on the stage and you give them their blocking. And at any given time, they'll say, "This doesn't make sense to me. They try to handle a lot of their issues prior to getting to the stage. But if they get out there and something doesn't make sense, or they don't like a move, there's, some of the stronger characters, then I'll say, "Look, tell me what you want to do. Show me what you want to do. That makes sense to me. I just need you to be here at this point." And then I'll run it with them, and I don't give line readings at all. Sometimes if they're younger actors, you sort of explain what that line means relative to what's going on. And they go, "Oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense to me. That makes sense." So it's like anything else. Like you're, any student, you urge them along in there, but they come very prepared. I would say this show particularly, so prepared. It's the shows where people get kind of lazy because they've been on it a long time.
Right.
But this cast is just like on it. It's amazing. And they have so many lines. It's crazy.
What about young actors? I mean, you have children on the shows.
Children. Yeah, not a lot. But usually you try to set it up for an edit. So if they don't make it into their mark, or they don't, or they go, the whole thing is set up so that you can stop and start with the close-up and go over, do it again. You always have ways to redo it. I've never done a scene that goes straight through. You always go back and pick up stuff. Or an actor will flub it, or they don't like the way they said it. You always go back.
And when you have an actor who's been doing the part, you know, like forever, and now there's this new young director who came in to work on it, do you get resistance from is there diva quality to some of the people?
Never, not on this show I have it, but I have had on other shows, you get, especially when the crew, when it keeps changing, like the writers change, or there's a new producer, or there's that, you'll get a lot of, my character wouldn't say that. My character wouldn't do that. Done it like that. And a little more obstinate at times. But if you do, that's where you have to be really prepared. You have to go out there and say, look, okay, I get that. Why don't we cut this? What if you went right from here to here? Does that clean it up for you? And a lot of times it does. It's just a matter of it's too wordy, or it's too, it goes to in another direction that they don't understand, or it doesn't really, or they're right. The character would never say that. So it's because sometimes it just slips through. So you can always just say, okay, look, let's do this. Take that to there. Now just going in and being a director and not part of the producing team makes it a little harder for me, because I always have to come back to Lou and say, look, make sure upstairs is happy with this cut. Right. You know, and usually they're fine because I can see what they need. But if it's elaborate, you have to bring the executive down to say, okay, because the writers don't like you switching their stuff around.
When you're executive producer and you're in charge of everything, so does that mean costumes too, what the characters are going to wear? Or do you just delegate, oh, the costume people will take care of that?
Well, you're sort of, there's a, when you first start, characters have a, what they're going to wear, but especially on big shows where they're dressing up, we see it prior to them coming on, or the costume people will come up and say, What do you think about this? Especially if it's a wedding, or it's wedding dresses, or it's bridesmaids, or it's a party. Regular daily clothes that they wear are very curated to the characters. And this show, Beyond the Gates, has an entire upstairs, and every character has their own wardrobe part. And That's very curated. The jewelry, everything they wear, is a very wealthy family.
And do you get, do you have deals with clothing designers and jewelry makers to use their product?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's just kind of all purchased and comes out. Sometimes it comes out of the vast wardrobe. Like when I got married, I just picked my favorite character's wedding dress and I picked my favorite bridesmaid dresses from another wedding. And I wore that. Put them all in a garbage bag and send them back to the studio then. Very, very
economical. Of working in the television. But the clothes you're wearing now, they're your own, or they were previously worn?
This for your, they know. I don't like wearing other people's clothes, but when the wedding dress is like, what am I doing? You know, we did it in our backyard. It was very easy, but it was fun. It was fun to have a fancy dress and give it back.
Your children are not interested in the show business, or are they?
No, the closest one is my daughter, who wants to write. And so a couple summers ago, before she started law school, I said, well, I'll write a book with you. And we wrote it was her story. She did the lion's share of it, but it was a horror story. And it was really fun writing with her. She's very, very good. And my job was to sit with her and say, okay, no, which you do in a soap opera is, okay, new writers always like to add characters. And you go, no, that character can say all that. That can happen with that character. We don't want to cast five more people. We want to complicate the people we have. So, you know, whether it's an evil twin or they're coming back from the dead, you don't want to add more characters. You don't want to do another contract. And I kept thinking of this book as something that she could maybe sell as a series, as like a horror series, but she's still working on it, but she went to law school, so we're at a standstill. But it was really fun for me because she's a young writer, and she would listen to me when I said, okay, nope, you got to keep it this way. Keep too many sets, too many scenes, too many people. You know, we don't want to get to know another character. We want this character. So that was fun. I was able to use it with her, and she will end up being a writer in the long run. She's got working for Wilson Sonsini starting in the fall, but I think she'll end up back at writing.
Oh, good. Well, I hope she'll come on the show here on the bookshelf and tell me about her.
Yeah, she gets her first book.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to ask more about the writing on a soap like that you were the producer of, or on Beyond the Gates for that matter. there's a room full of writers. I mean, do you know where the story is going? Does the story sometimes surprise you? Like, oh yeah, we could do that. I mean, how do you plot it out?
Surprises, but it has to be so planned out. So what happens is there's a head writer. In our case, it's Michelle Valjean, who used to work as an outline writer and head writer, different variations of writers from other shows I was on. So I know her. But she and her team, so she has a little team, and they'll come and pitch a long term. Like, we want to do this. We want to take this character, turn them to go this way. They're going to fall in love, whatever their long-term ideas are. And then we as producers, not me on Beyond the Gates, but in other shows, we go, well, okay, that sounds like a good idea, but we really like this, or we think we should head towards a wedding or head towards, you know, an almost drowning or something. You know, whatever it is, we'll put our 2 cents in. And then they come back with this long term, which we call it arc. Arc's over 3 to 4 months. We all go home and read it that weekend and come back. And we, if they're not in town, the writers, we're all on speakerphones or like this now. And our 2 cents goes into that long term. And that's where I say it's very delicate, because, you know, writers put a lot into what they've written, and it's respectfully, you have to know that. And then you have to know as a producer that what's not going to work, or financially what we cannot do. You know, sometimes they have, you know, huge ideas and no, we just did the explosion and we don't have money to do another explosion. We have to do this, or we want the show to get into a more of an emotional level. In any case, it goes through that process. Then they pitch it all out to their 5 outline writers, and each one of those writers writes a day based on that long term. And then we all read that again, and you make your comments, you know, here's that scene. We don't want that. Blah, blah, blah. So there's that, and that gets rewritten. And then those outlines go to a separate group of dialogue writers. So it's a big process, but it keeps going. I mean, it never stops. It's like, finally they have these hiatuses. Now we never had the hiatuses because we always shot
working.
Just
yeah. It just kept working.
Everybody's off for a month.
That's really nice.
What
about politics? I mean, everything is political now and politicized. Do you have to, and now you have a show in which all of the characters are African-American, which in itself is a political statement.
Not all of them. They're just
the main characters.
Like, the main, like if you think of the Quartermains on General Hospital as the main family and everything kind of spurs out of that.
Yeah.
That's the same with Beyond the Gates, the main family. And then some of the family members are married to white. There's a gay storyline. There's two gay storylines actually. And those, there are political things that go on or underlining. There was an underlying racist story. You know, they add a lot of that in, you know.
And are there guidelines where we can't do that. That's too political. Or do you just, if it makes sense, we'll do it.
I think if it makes sense, we'll do it. I think that there are some guidelines you have to be a little, you know, sensitive to, especially with the climate we have now.
Yeah.
But I think they're pretty good about being open with that. And I don't know. I think you want to read it and be very sensitive to your audience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the past, there have been things like Erica Kane having an abortion or something like that. It turned out to be very, those are very polarizing.
Yeah, they're tricky. Those are very tricky. You have to be very careful with these kinds of, we just did a storyline on Beyond the Gates of the BRCA gene and cancer and which character decides to have all the surgeries, it does to the married couple, you know, a woman feeling disformed. So they sort of hit every level of that. And they did another storyline where there was a group of racists that attacked one of, like, it's a backstory that one of the characters can't stop dreaming about. Mm. And it was this racist storyline, and it was heavy. They do that, but they try to keep also, there's the love story and there's the this. We didn't do back in the day a lot of gay stories. They're doing two gay stories, two men and two women. And we didn't do, we just never did anything like that then.
Oh, and all the characters were primarily white. They would have some sort of subsidiary black characters in the old days.
Yeah, certainly not as many as this show has. We had them on Days of Our Life. We had them. But again, the majority was white. And now the majority is black on this, which is very interesting and fun. And it's whole new kinds of stories and an amazing group of actors, too.
But no sharks. You haven't involved sharks at all in any of this. So
just the network when they come in.
The network sharks.
The network sharks. Yeah, there's always the network who they do have some final say on stuff.
So what about that moment before we end today? I want to know that when they say, and the winner is, and you get up there and you get that Emmy Award, how does that feel? What's that like?
It feels great. It's very fun, especially, I don't know, I'm going to go to this next Emmy. I haven't been to the Emmys for a long time, but we used to fly to New York and it was all televised. It was so much fun. You'd see everybody and that was fun in itself, just to see all the different shows. And then when your show starts to win and it's, you know, the lead actor, then we get called up. You know, I'm looking out at everybody going, oh my God, they're so mad. This is like our fifth in a row, right? But it's really fun. It's a very good feeling because you work so hard and you really, there's not a lot of recognition, especially if you're behind the cameras. You're not an actor going out onto the shows. It's only been lately that people are interested in the behind the scenes a little bit more, but this is your moment to go with all that hard work, all those late nights. This is such a great fine reward. So
and well deserved. Shelley Curtis, yeah. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. Fascinating life.
Thank you for having me. And just know you're still very, very cute as you were in high school.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.